Weather Brains.
This time on Weather Brains, it's 2:15 in the morning, and you're standing in the middle of a peach orchard. The temperature is 27 degrees, but it's not a still, quiet night. You might be hearing this. Helicopters to the rescue. We'll explain in a Weather Brains Extra, the big chill.
We had a very cold weather, 22 degrees.
We look at the impact of early April cold on a lot of the crops for foods we like to eat.
It's completely destroyed our bunch grape crop.
We'll have the cold facts coming up. Plus,
the best heater out there is a return stack heater.
Return stack heater.
Yeah.
And describe that for me.
Kevin Selly looks at some of the technology farmers use to minimize cold weather damage to their livelihoods. Also this time,
we had the broad rotation go right overhead.
James Spann actually goes storm chasing?
It was really exciting.
He tells us about it. Plus, fresh water. J.B. Elliott shows us why we shouldn't take it for granted. That and more coming up. It's episode number 64 of Weather Brains. Welcome. We're the netcast that's all about weather. I'm David Black, and with me for this ride is James Spann, J.B. Elliott, Bill Murray, and Kevin Selly. And James, I understand that you did something for the first time a few days ago. You haven't done it in a long time anyway. Tell me about that.
Oddly enough, getting out in the weather, David, you know, for a lot of television weather people, we are strapped to these offices, and I can't remember the last time I was actually out in severe weather, so I gave it a shot this weekend and had an amazing day.
Imagine James Spann storm chasing. Kevin, that must have been quite a sight.
I would like to do that, too. I'd like to go up and chase this big storm on the East Coast and feel those 150-mile-an-hour wind gusts on Mount Washington, David. This thing's been a bear.
Man, the weather across the northeastern U.S. Just been awesome, and I'm really grateful for not being one of the people stuck trying to travel in it. Bill Murray, you're somebody who travels a lot. You have managed to avoid getting in the mess in the northeast U.S., so you're doing something right.
Absolutely, David. I'm so glad to be here. We had plenty of wind for me yesterday. I couldn't imagine running the Boston Marathon. That must have been an incredible experience in those 40-mile-an-hour winds.
I think I'll pass on that. Well, looking at weather around the area, Old Man Winter levels a fierce blast at the northeast U.S. And suppose that people concerned about climate change hold a global warming rally that few attend because it's too cold. Kevin Selly has the week in weather.
The week in weather from weatherparty.com. Big storm system crawled up the East Coast over the weekend, causing delays, floods, and records.
It appears to be at least the strongest nor'easter of this cool season, including last fall, winter, and this spring. It got down to at least 965 millibars this morning. The rainfall that occurred in Central Park, where they received over 7 inches of rain, 781 to be exact, that's the second wettest calendar day in their recorded history.
That was Bruce Terry, lead forecaster for the National Weather Service in Washington. A recent accounting study from the Government Accountability Office shows the Florida National Guard has only about 53% of what is called dual-use equipment available for response to tropical storms. Texas and Louisiana are also showing similar equipment levels. Lawmakers are concerned ahead of the approaching hurricane season that Guard troops will not be prepared for landfalling storms, but Guard officials say they are prepared.
We've got more equipment here in Florida now with Florida National Guard. We have more equipment and personnel than what we had during those 8 hurricanes back-to-back.
Lieutenant Colonel Ron Tittle. The shortage is being blamed on equipment that has been sent to Iraq and Afghanistan. From Reno, Nevada, a planned global warming rally attracted about a dozen people, organized as part of a national rally to urge Congress to adopt a plan to cut carbon emissions by 80% by the year 2050. The event was cut short from a planned 2 hours to only one. Organizers had hoped to use solar ovens for a potluck picnic. The reason cited for the low turnout, shortened event, and no picnic: cold temperatures and a winter-like storm with rain and sleet. And finally, two dolphins gave birth to two babies earlier this month at the Atlantis Paradise Island Resort in the Bahamas. Mothers and calves are reported to be doing well, with the babies plumping up nicely. Another baby is expected this summer. This counts as weather news because all of the dolphins are refugees from the Mississippi Marine Park that was destroyed during Hurricane Katrina. You might remember some of the animals were swept out into the Gulf of Mexico during the storm. That's the week in weather. For more weather news and information, visit weatherparty.com.
Thank you, Kevin Selle. You know, this big, powerful northeast storm has been a lot more than just inconvenient for some folks. It's really having a brutal economic impact on various crops across the country, and that affects a lot of people because a lot of people like to eat. We've got a Weather Brains Extra this time for you called The Big Chill. Now, think grapes and wine. Is the first place that comes to mind Altus, Arkansas? Not for me, but that's where John Post and his family run Post Family Vineyards. Post says his bunch grapes have been wiped out by a weather double whammy that started back on April 6th.
We're an old family-owned operation. I'm fifth generation, and we're Swiss-German and have been in business since 1880.
Wow. How big of an operation do you have?
We have several hundred acres of grapes and then a good mid-sized winery. We've been in, I'm trying to think how I would describe us. I mean, we're a family-owned business, so we're a small business. But as far as wineries go, we're fairly large.
When I think of wine, I don't really think of Arkansas.
Well, many people don't. But it might surprise you that Arkansas is among the top 12 wine-growing states in the United States.
So how important is weather to you?
Weather's critical. Some varieties, like muscadines, are indigenous to Arkansas and hardy and resistant to spring frost. Other varieties of viniferas are very sensitive to spring frost. The problem is that we had an unseasonably warm spring, and the growth in the grapes was advanced. When the primary and secondary buds are all out and have shoots, you are very sensitive to a frost. And so we had a very cold weather, 22 degrees Fahrenheit, and it set a all-time recorded history cold in this area by 10 degrees.
I'm almost afraid to ask what this has done to you.
It's completely destroyed our bunch grape crop. I think we'll harvest none this year. So it's complete and utter destruction. We hope that the state can give the grape farmers some help.
What does this mean to your operation?
Well, this means we'll have to go out of state for fruit this year. On our varieties like muscadine, I still hold out some hope that we'll have a good crop. But on our other bunch grapes, we'll have to go out of state.
Can you estimate any sort of financial impact at this point?
Well, the financial impact will be a great hardship on the grape farmers. I don't think the wineries will suffer as much because they can turn to other sources for the fruit. Some varieties of grapes that really aren't sold on the open market, we produce Ives Noir and some varieties like Vigneault that aren't as popular, that aren't really commodity grapes on the open market like, say, Cabernet or Merlot or Chardonnay would be. And those varieties will just probably disappear from the shelves for a year.
So the people who grow the grapes, who are out in the fields doing the hard work, so to speak, are the ones really taking the beating here?
They are. I mean, they lost a year's salary. So it will be difficult for them to make that up.
Have you ever had anything like this happen before? Has the weather been this tough on you before?
I talked to my dad about this, and he's 82 years old. He said he's never seen this in his lifetime, and he's farmed grapes his entire life. He told me that of a conversation with his grandfather, and together the two of them then would span almost 150 years of grape growing in Arkansas. And his grandfather told him he has never seen 100% crop failure due to a freeze in Arkansas.
Roughly how many acres would you say are wiped out so I can have a better understanding of the size here we're talking about?
In Arkansas, I would estimate that about 700 acres were demolished.
What other crops does Arkansas grow that you know of that are in peril because of this?
Well, I've heard that sorghum, winter wheat, the peaches are greatly damaged. Blueberries are mostly gone. Anybody growing their nut crops are pretty much put a a big hit on them.
So grapes are but one victim in this.
Sure, we're, you know, it's our world, but and so it's huge to us. But I know many other farmers also suffered through this. We have I think the United States' largest blackberry producer is here in Arkansas, and he told me they have suffered about a 20% crop loss.
You guys really kind of had a double whammy because you said things were warming up to start with, so some of the grapes were maturing quicker than otherwise might be the case.
That's true.
And then you get slammed by bitter cold.
That's one reason that, say, further north, the damage of this was not as great, because the colder temperatures further north keep the grapes from springing out as quickly. So their growth wasn't as advanced, and they weren't as sensitive to a late freeze. Now, down here, we were unseasonably warm this spring, and the canes were several feet long. So the freeze just absolutely wiped them out. They're hanging straight down, and most of them now you can grab with your hands, and they just are crunchy.
That's John Post with Post Family Vineyards in Altus, Arkansas. And we're going to put a link to their vineyard website. It's a pretty nice website, too, on our website, weatherbrains.com. Now, further east in Georgia, specialty crop farmers have taken a real beating from cold weather as well. Tommy Irvin is Agriculture Commissioner for the state of Georgia. So, Commissioner, have any particular crops been hit really hard?
I would say probably in a state like Georgia, the hardest hit crop was probably peaches. We've been known as a peach state, and we grow a very quality, very good tasting peach, and it's been in most areas of the state really just destroyed. In the northern part of our state, it looks like we've had terrific losses on things like our peaches and our apples and blueberries and strawberries and things that emerged from the soil. And the wine vineyards, we've been working very hard to produce a quality grape to make wines, and it looks terrifying what has happened to that industry. So it's just it's been nearly a wipeout in some areas of our state. All over the state, we've suffered a good bit of loss, and it's been kind of a very, very, very difficult time for farmers in Georgia, as they have been in many other southern states.
Any idea what the likelihood is going to be that prices may go up for some of these for consumers?
Well, I would say that in many cases, I think only prices will be affected, but availability will probably be affected too, because you have as much loss as we seem to be experiencing. It'll make a lot of the products that we've been accustomed to buying on a seasonal basis not available.
I understand you've been commissioner there for quite some time.
Only 38 years.
Only, okay.
I'm in training.
Where would you say this rates in terms of severity?
Well, I think that when you consider the season that we're in, it's the worst. But we've had more dollar losses when we've had droughts in past years, because we've had some years when we had nearly a wipe out of what we call our big cash crop.
Now, those big cash crops Commissioner Tommy Irvin is talking about, peanuts and cotton among them, are safe, he says. That's because they have not yet been planted. And if you're a fan of Georgia's famous Vidalia onions, Irvin says there's no reason to be worried about those either. Also in the Southeast, April's cold means devastation for some farmers in Alabama, but not all. The peaches, grown in central Alabama's Chilton County, are popular nationwide. Danny Jones runs Durbin Farms Market in Clanton, Alabama. Now, his peaches escaped damage from the cold, but that's only because of extraordinary steps he had to take at 2:15 on a cold April morning.
We've got a very good crop. But we flew two helicopters. We have six wind machines, and we burned coal at night, I mean, to try to heat up certain cold spots of the field, and we were able to pull through it.
But if you hadn't done that, you might be looking
at probably wouldn't have a peach.
Wow.
And I mean, that's what's happened to a lot of your growers, especially a lot of your smaller growers, that actually just could not afford to do it. You know, just sticking their neck so far out on the limb, because you're going to spend... I mean, we flew two helicopters, so you're looking probably around $10,000-$12,000 to fly helicopters. And there's a lot of people just could not afford that expense of jumping out there. Because if it didn't work, what they would be faced with.
Now, there are a lot of other peach farms in your area. Does that mean some of the other folks may have really been bitten badly by the cold?
Some have been bitten real badly, and some, I mean, there was other people that flew helicopters. So, and there was some, you know, it saved, you know, more than others. And it's like with anything else. In the peach industry, it's your location. I mean, you've got your hot spots and your cold spots.
You guys got down into the 20s, right?
Yeah, we got down to 27, 28. When a weather storm like this hits, when something like this, I mean, we're all faced with the same animal. I mean, everybody has to stay on top of it. You have to stay in the field and keep a check on your trees, keep a check on the temperature, and have everything lined up. I mean, have to have the helicopters on standby. One when it was over one field, and another one was over another 40-acre block, and then we had six wind machines blowing on the other side of the orchard. So
sounds expensive.
It's very expensive. But, I mean, Durbin Farmers Market is a peach market, so we have to have peaches.
So you have to raise your prices to cover for that?
No, I mean, we grow a premium peach, and we pack a premium peach. So we ask a set price, and that's the way it is. We won't go up because of this freeze. I mean, we get a good price anyway. And I don't want to jab a customer just because I could, because of, you know, other farmers have lost. But our crop, we still got a good crop. But I want my customers to come back next year.
So if I were able to talk to the various peach farms in your area, some came through okay, but I'd be talking to some who lost virtually, what, everything?
That's right. You'd be getting two and three and four different stories because it was all according to how their property laid.
I appreciate your talking with us, and good luck, okay?
Hey, come see me at Durbin.
Oh, we'll be looking forward to your peaches.
Okay.
That's Danny Jones with Durbin Farms Market in Clanton, Alabama. Growers have reported up to 80% loss at some Chilton County orchards. Now, as you can tell, farmers like Danny make big use of technology to try and prevent cold weather damage to their crops, and they're out in the middle of the night doing it. When your livelihood depends on being able to save your crops from frigid air, it pays to know about the steps you can take, and those steps are something that Kevin Selly's been looking into. Kev, what have you been learning?
Yeah, David, there are some ways to fight off old man winter, and I had a chance to visit with Dr. Arlie Powell, who is a retired horticulture professor and administrator at Auburn University, and he told me how growers fight the freeze with fire, water, and wind.
The wind machine normally has a tower on it, and they vary from 40 to 60 feet, sometimes a little lower than that, sometimes seldom higher than that. But an average wind machine can displace and move air around on roughly 10 acres.
For just one machine?
That's right.
How big across are they?
That blade must be 10 to 14 feet. See, the other thing is you don't want to run it off electricity. If the power goes out during the night, you've got a major problem. So you always run it off of an independent energy source, such as gasoline or diesel or what have you, or propane. Now, some wind machines are double-bladed. That is, you have a blade on one side and a blade on the other side. And they'll protect probably another 4 or 5 acres, maybe 15 acres.
And sometimes they will use a much bigger fan, not just to move the air around, but mix different layers.
If you've got a helicopter, every 30 minutes, he needs to be in the same spot again. And what he does, he basically flies the inversion layer, and that's a layer of air. Remember I said that the surface of the earth starts cooling as well as the plants. As that cooling occurs, down near the surface of the earth where we walk around and breathe air, it gets colder there than it does aloft. And at about 100 feet, 150 feet, sometimes much less than that, maybe only 50 feet or 25 feet, the temperature is warmer. So we'll give you an example. When we were flying, we had a temperature varied between 28 and 30 degrees. The temperature where the helicopter was 36 to 40 degrees. So he was pushing air that was 36 to 40 degrees down into the plantings and mixing that air with the colder air that was at the surface.
Like an expensive proposition to fly over a field all night, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. And people want to know what the cost is. Well, the cost of flying a helicopter can vary from the lowest that you'll see most any copter fly for, and depending on the size, is like probably $450 to $550 an hour. Big helicopters can charge and do from $1,500 to $2,000 an hour. So you have to weigh, whether you're doing some good versus the cost. And but if you don't fly and you still have a helicopter sitting on your property, you pay them a cost, is what's called standby. And standby is usually several hundred dollars for them simply to be there, even though they don't go up. But I tell you what, when you're protecting crops and you're using a helicopter, the peace of mind it gives the grower to know that copter is sitting there and it can be in the air in 15 minutes helps you get through the night. It's like insurance.
Another type of insurance or active protection is heaters that burn some type of fuel. You may have seen those glowing on TV in the orange fields in Florida, perhaps, and some are better than others.
The best heater out there is a return stack heater.
Return stack heater.
Yeah.
And describe that for me, please.
Well, a return stack heater is a heater devised with a base that contains the fuel, and it has a stack that goes up above that base, and at the bottom of it is just full of fuel, and you've got it lit. And then you have a return stack on that little stack that's going straight up that reburns some of the air that's being given off, and it just simply gives you a little more radiational heat. Heat is transferred by conduction. That is, if you hold a spoon and I take a match and I light that spoon, and I'm holding one end and you're holding the other, and if I'm putting a heat on that match and you're holding the other end, in just a matter of less than 60 seconds, you're going to feel the heat. Because it's transferred molecule to molecule. That's called conduction. Convection is where you move heat by air. That is, you generate some heat and you blow it with a blower or a fan or what have you. The other way is radiant heat. And radiant heat is if you can see that burner, that heater, the face of it, everything that can see it is in a straight line radiational benefit, because it will receive, just like the sun, when the sun is using ultraviolet radiation coming down at us. Both of those aspects are important. The downside, when I was growing up in Florida and working in citrus, it was quite common to have all these heaters out there. But the heat per se cost a lot of money today. You would have to use 30 to 40 heaters, sometimes more, to protect. Oh, gosh, you could put 30 heaters in 1 acre. Sometimes they scatter them out, and they only put 10 to 20 heaters per acre. But it takes a lot of heaters to warm that area, the air, using what we call active protection.
Significantly more expensive than the fans.
Well, it is. You got the cost of the heaters, and again, you have to depreciate those off when you buy them because they last several years. You got the cost of the fuel, and then you got the cost of the labor. Now, see, with a helicopter, the only labor I've got is the pilot that's in that airplane. So when you add all those costs together, probably a wind machine is the cheapest of all of them if you depreciate it out and what have you, and probably a helicopter would be next.
And then we get into some real neat science, irrigation.
Water is a wonderful thing, and water has what's called sensible heat. That is, if you and I take water and it's 70 degrees during that freeze night, as that water drops from 70 degrees down to the air temperature at the spot where you have it located, it's releasing heat, and that heat helps add, if you will, to the heat balance in that orchard, which means the temperature stays up longer. And that works great because here we're using not sensible heat, but latent heat effusion. And that's just a fancy term for letting you know that when that liquid water converts to ice, it releases heat. And that heat, if you were monitoring it with a very careful sensor, you would see that it would raise the air temperature roughly a half a degree when that ice water freezes and turns into ice. But the key on it is not that. The key is if you're putting this on trees or let's say strawberries, the plus is if you keep your system operating, that you can maintain the temperature of whatever you're protecting, the fruit, the flower, the leaf, at 31.5 degrees. That's the beauty of it. And you do this simply by allowing fresh water to be continually applied to that tissue, and as that fresh water freezes, it maintains the heat of the ice that's covering that plant. It maintains it at 31.5. Now, if you cut your system off, something happens. You froze the plant, and 1 o'clock, your irrigation system shuts down. Ice is a poor insulator. So now you got a reversal. You got a disaster on your hands, because unless you can provide fresh water that's constantly freezing, if that temperature drops below 22 and or you have considerable wind, the evaporative cooling effect is more than the heat you're getting out of the ice.
I actually pulled some numbers from your paper online. It says 1 gram
of water freezing adds 80 calories of heat, but 1 gram evaporating removes 600 calories of heat. So you have to use 7.5 times more water to keep that thing in balance.
Absolutely correct.
Which is an amazing challenge in my mind, because you're not static on your temperature all night. This is something that has to be monitored and adjusted continually then.
That's correct. Absolutely. Not only that, those sprinkler heads will freeze. And when they freeze in place, you've got to go out there in a wet field with all the water going on you and dislodge that head so that it begins to turn, because those heads are supposed to turn 360 degrees. And when they freeze, I've seen people shoot at them with a shotgun.
So the advice there, David, is if you're passing by any peach farms during cold weather, stay low.
Man, I've got to say one thing right off the bat. When I listen to all of the steps, the things that Mr. Powell's talking about, things that Danny Jones in Clanton with the peach farm talk about, how do these people endure this financially if they get wiped out? You know,
it's a wonder that peaches don't cost $100 per.
I know. That's just amazing to me, and I gain a new appreciation for what it takes to keep the crops healthy and stable so that we can go pick up peaches at the stand or in the grocery store or blueberries or whatever else might be the case. Anyway, interesting piece. Thank you, Kev. Weather roundtable time. We got some topics to talk about this time, and we're going to kind of make a change from the cold to the stormy weather that preceded the cold across a large part of the southern United States. James Spann, you got to go storm chasing, something you really don't get to do very often in your life because you're usually doing television coverage of severe weather.
You know, it's funny, David. I have been almost confined to these weather offices since 1978. That's the year I started doing this. So getting out in a big severe weather outbreak is pretty unusual for me. And quite frankly, I think I need that, and that you need to get out in the field and actually experience this stuff from time to time. So this past weekend, when it was obvious that the worst of the severe weather would not be in my market, but about 120 miles south of here, I got none other than Brian Peters, and we got in a storm chase van and headed south. And, you know, in Alabama, you don't storm chase. You kind of storm spot.
Right.
And we got down below Montgomery, Alabama, and picked a spot in the southern part of the state where a big rotating supercell was approaching. And we couldn't have picked a better spot. And it was really exciting. I mean, I don't have a story like Bill Murray where you see all these tornadoes, but we had broad rotation go right overhead. We did have some wind damage within about 3 miles of our spot, and there was a tornado warning. And you know, I don't have the funnel cloud or even a wall cloud to show, but it was exhilarating. It was pretty exciting stuff. So well, we got that on the way back. We got to eat some good barbecue.
Yeah, well, that's a good little perk, too. Now, one thing that you guys have that's a real advantage, but it certainly is a safety issue, too, is you've got access to some really good information, communications, and technology so that you would not wind up in a bad place.
Right. And, you know, Brian is a lot like me. Brian was the WCM for the Weather Service in Birmingham for a long time, and accordingly, he couldn't get out when the weather was going on. He would go out and do storm surveys. So for both of us, it was pretty exciting. And within that van, we have, you know, internet access, so we can see the live radar. We've got amateur radio gear, and both Brian and I are licensed ham radio operators, so we could communicate with the spotters, other spotters in the field, and with the Weather Service. And, you know, everything we needed was there. We had televisions in there. We watched the Montgomery television stations, and it was just really exciting. It took a lot of pictures, and it was absolutely fascinating. So, and I don't know if I'll get to do that again for another 10 years, so it was good to get out while I can.
That sounds like fun. J.B. Elliott, you have really been watching something that's been affecting people across a large part of the country, and that is the lack of rain.
David, I must admit, I will be 75 years old in a day or so, and I have lived through lots of droughts. I became interested in droughts somewhat. I don't know why. But I'm also afraid of droughts, and I hate droughts. But was it Benjamin Franklin that said one time that when the well runs dry, we really know how important water is at that time?
Yeah.
97% of the world's water is undrinkable because it's the salt water in the oceans. And only 3% is fresh water. Two-thirds of that 3% is ice locked up in glaciers in the vast polar ice caps, especially the one at Antarctica. So we face a shortage of fresh water not only in the United States, but around the world. Here in the USA, it's estimated that we withdraw 339 billion gallons of surface and groundwater each day. It's also estimated that we get 4 trillion gallons of water in the USA each day as precipitation, but a lot of that evaporates and is runoff. There's no change in the available water. It's been the same since way back when, well, when since Brian Peters was born. But
that's
the
a
big problem.
The
big problem, he's going to get me, the big problem is the exploding world population. There's a huge influx of population also into the desert areas of the western USA. Las Vegas and Phoenix are booming in population. All of those people seem to want swimming pools and fountains. Mm-hmm. And I believe in Las Vegas they're trying to recycle as much water as they can through those huge fountains that they have. But at the present time, it is extremely dry across Arkansas, North Louisiana, the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, very dry. The rainfall deficiency is now approaching 11 inches in parts of Alabama. Much of the West is also very dry. Reservoirs are low. There's an extreme drought going on over southwest Arizona and southern California. We've all seen the stories of the wildfires. So that's the situation as it stands now. We just need more fresh water.
You know, hearing you talk about those, give those statistics makes me, I'm going to go out on a limb here, makes me suspect that you're one of the people who, if you're like me, when you brush your teeth in the morning and you see the water coming out of the faucet in the sink there, I don't take that for granted. And
I sure don't.
You know, I in all seriousness, I really do turn the water down to a real low trickle if I'm not actually using it. And I know there's so many people who just, you know, let it run full blast. And Kevin, do you ever notice things like that and take those things into account?
Yeah, I definitely do. And you know what's interesting? I was just reading the other day in a financial publication. The theory was that the companies, there are a handful of companies that deal in water purification and that type of thing, water reclamation. And the theory in this publication was that those companies will do very well on their stock prices in the years ahead, as we have to dig and dig and find and scrape for every little bit of water, especially with such a growing population, David.
Yeah, it's a scary thing. And I get concerned about world conflict developing over things that we just take so for granted here, things like water.
When I take a shower, I turn the water on long enough to get wet, then I turn it off and soap up, and then rinse off. So use about 1/4 as much water as you would normally use in a shower.
You do that every day?
Yes.
Wow.
That's why he looks so good at 75. Happy birthday, by the way.
Yeah, happy birthday,
Jay. Thank you.
That's outstanding.
Nikita Khrushchev and I have the same birthday, so.
Okay. Well, we're going to be all at your place for cake and ice cream. Be sure to get Kevin directions, and we'll be looking forward to that.
I really feel like I'm 45, and I want to outlive Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes without working.
You will. You sound like you're 35.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Sound like you're having fun. Well, speaking of time frames, this week in 1944, I think this was pre-Kevin and pre-David. Anyway, this week in 1944 was a critical moment for the field of weather forecasting. That's when British and American forecasters came up with their first official forecast as part of planning for the D-Day invasion. And on this date in 1967, the worst nightmare for school officials and weather forecasters. Bill Murray has details on This Week in Weather History.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of April 17th through the 23rd. Did you know that weather forecasters played a huge role in the planning of the D-Day invasion? On April 17th, 1944, a joint team of British and American forecasters made their first official presentation of a 4-day forecast to commanders. A correct weather report would be critical to the success of the mission on June the 6th. On April 18, 1906, the city of San Francisco was nearly destroyed by a great earthquake and fire. The earthquake measured 8.3 on the Richter scale. The flames, which lasted for another 5 days, were fanned by an unusual easterly wind. 315 people died in the earthquake and fire. Another 350 were never found and presumed dead. April 18, 1970 was a devastating night for tornadoes in the Texas Panhandle. At least 4 F3 or F4 tornadoes slashed at the area between Amarillo and Lubbock. At the Lubbock U.S. Weather Bureau office, it had been a busy night issuing tornado warnings, but around midnight, the all-clear was sounded. But during the pre-dawn hours, another family of tornadoes swarmed across the Panhandle. The Sherwood Shores Resort on the Greenbelt Reservoir near Clarendon was directly in the path of one of the twisters. 13 people died in Sherwood Shores as the tornado struck without warning. For over 50 years in the early 20th century, the U.S. Weather Bureau had an official ban on using the word tornado in its forecasts. One of the reasons was concern that use of the word would cause widespread panic. There was an isolated case of panic on April 21, 1952, when an Altus, Oklahoma woman heard the tornado warning, jumped in her car to rush home, crashed the car, and died. But events like this were isolated, and the new tornado forecast began to actually save lives immediately. A nightmare for school officials and weather forecasters is a tornado that occurs around dismissal time. On April 21, 1967, high school students in Belvidere, Illinois, near Chicago, were being loaded onto buses as a deadly F4 tornado approached. The twister ripped directly through the bus loading area. 12 of the buses were overturned by the winds. 13 students were killed. Another 300 were injured. And another school bus was destroyed near Harvard, Illinois, as the driver and students took shelter in a ditch. Back in 2002, the first tornado fatality did not occur until April 21st. This is the latest first tornado fatality in U.S. history since records have been kept. We haven't been so fortunate this year. The first tornado fatality occurred on January 4th, and we have already recorded 50 tornado deaths this year, well above average, and approaching already the number that were killed in all of 2006. David, that's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Bill Murray.
Hey, David, you know, I came across something hearing that that school bus story that just came across on the internet here the last couple hours or so, but it deals with some tornadic activity that we had here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area last week. And there is a report, and I have not confirmed it yet, but the Dallas Area Rapid Transit, or the DART buses that drive people around the city, there's a report that when the tornado warnings were issued, that at least one of the buses threw everybody off the bus.
Wow.
I wanted to throw that out to you guys because they said apparently a voice came on the speaker and said all passengers must exit the bus and seek shelter. And your first thought is to go, well, wait a minute, how can you do that? But then you think, well, wait a minute, do you want to be in a vehicle like that when there's a tornado warning? So I thought I'd throw that to you guys and see what you thought.
So do they have some severe weather policy, I wonder? I guess this is a question of which is the less of the two evils.
I guess so. I'll have to follow up on it because I just found this just before we recorded the program. But I'll follow up with the DART people and see what they have to say. Maybe we can talk about that next week.
Do you know if they were near some kind of shelter when they made them get off the bus?
There is no indication. It was just on its route, and when the warning came over, they said, get off, and it appears that everybody just scattered to wherever they could go. And I don't believe they were directly near any of the tornadic activity, but again,
good
I can follow up. But
man.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because we always say, well, don't be in your car.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You don't want to be in the bus.
I would think that a policy like that would have to have some play, some flexibility in it based on where the bus is. You know, if it's close to a place that would be a good shelter, then it makes sense if you got time to get off. But, you know, do you have time? That's another big danger factor. You don't
always do. Please do follow up on that, Kevin.
I will. I'll follow up for the next program, I promise.
Kevin Selly now has his homework assignment while J.B. Elliott eats his birthday cake for number 75.
Number 75. I really do feel like 3-5 or 4-5.
Well, we're glad, and we expect many more years out of you, Mr. Elliott, okay?
The only bad part is my IQ is in free fall.
Well, that's okay, because you're with a bunch of weather geeks, and we can all relate to that. If you'd like to contact the weather geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. We also have a toll-free telephone number you may use from anywhere within the United States. It won't cost you a dime. Call 1-888-247-8627. Again, 888-247-8627. Hey, JB, maybe somebody will call and wish you happy birthday. You never know. Or maybe just say hello to Miss Molly, your puppy. Never can.
Yeah, she's already wished me happy birthday.
Okay. For the Weather Brains crew, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, Kevin Selly, and Bill Murray, I'm David Blackley. Thank you for listening and hope that you can join us again for our next Weather Brains Netcast. Weather Brains is copyright 2007. All rights reserved. Adios. Guys, thanks very much. Happy birthday, J.B.
Thank you, sir.
I challenge listeners to call the toll-free number that's on the website and sing happy birthday to JB.
I would love that.
Let's do it, David. You ready?
I'm for it.
Happy birthday to you.
You know, it's not pretty if we sing. That's just not a strength for me, and JB probably wouldn't appreciate it anyway.
I appreciate anything.
It's the thought that counts, hopefully.
Absolutely.
All right, you guys, be good.
Happy birthday, JB.
Thank you, sir.
Hasta linguini.
Bye. Great job.